Well, I'd like to thank Dr. Friedman for inviting me to participate in this conference and share this workshop with Dr. Myers this morning. And Dr. Myers said something about Dr. Friedman chose the title of his talk, and he chose mine also. So that's the title that's up here in blue, Detecting and Avoiding Errors in Clinical Pathology Labs with a Special Emphasis on Lab Automation. And I've subtitled it, How Information Technology and Automation Can Positively Impact Clinical Laboratory Processes and Quality. And what I'm really going to do in this talk is take you through the entire cycle of a clinical laboratory test from the moment the physician is scratching his head and thinking of what tests should I order until the very end in our process when specimens that have completed the testing cycle are being discarded. So we will look at laboratory ordering processes. We'll look at some methodologies for tracking specimens and or shipments in the case of referral laboratories, which we are. Accessioning processes. We'll look at some other pre-analytical processes and automation related to pre-analytical processes. In particular, some new technologies called machine vision that are capable of doing quality inspections. In the analytic area, which is perhaps the most developed area, really, for information technology, because now we have middleware. We've always, for years, had quality control systems. Auto verification has now come of age and is used in many laboratories. Special calculated results, reflexive testing, and then in the post-analytic area, at least in the sense of determining which specimens you need to retrieve for a repeat test or an additional test or for other related activities, there are ways to use information technology. So in the pre-analytic area, guiding the physicians to order correct tests, physician could still go the old-fashioned way and look it up in a book, or maybe if he doesn't know, he or she doesn't know what to order. But and there are guidelines. I've listed the websites for actually more patient-oriented websites, WebMD and Lab Tests Online, which was a venture of the American Association for Clinical Chemistry and has been highly successful. It's one of the most visited websites out there. But what I'd like to talk about actually is a website that ARUP developed, and I really don't want this to be a commercial talk, but this is such a unique website, and it's won a number of awards, and it's really worth mentioning. And I know that you can't read this, the print is too small, but the ARUP consult is free, it's on the ARUP website, and it's downloadable to a PDA. And you choose the disease that you're interested in. In this case, I put up celiac disease. And then there's some headings across the top that you can see here where you can choose from a tab on clinical background or a tab on diagnosis or the lab test, which would be the lab test to order, references, and then an algorithm. And then there will be clinical information that's been written by the ARUP medical directors about this particular disease entity and the tests and so forth. This is the algorithm for celiac disease, and again, I realize you can't read this, but as I understand, all of these talks are going to be on the conference website after the conference, and so you'll be able to pull this up. But of course, you can just go to www.labconsult.com to the ARUP website, and you can see all this for yourself. Some people may even try it on their PDAs, but hopefully you wait till after my talk is finished before you start playing with it. But this algorithm, if you follow it down, is your standard medical algorithm that could enable you to make the decisions about what tests to order, and depending on the results, then what to do next, and that sort of thing. So I pose this simply as the very first step in the clinical laboratory testing cycle, as a way of adding some quality and adding some and making some improvements in how we do things. In the laboratory ordering processes, the examples that I've got here are based on a PC-based system that we have, that we provide to tend to be smaller clients who haven't developed a regular LIS to LIS interface. It's a system we call our System 2000, and we've designed some things in System 2000 to really guide the process to enable the client to submit the correct specimens for the test. And so it's a more interactive kind of process. So here you see an example in which the person's to indicate what temperature the specimen is they have, and so there's a code for a dark blue tube, and that specimen could be either refrigerated or ambient. Either is acceptable. So they're going to click on the right one, what they have, so they tell us if that specimen they're submitting is refrigerated or ambient. This is just a very small example. This system has the capability of guiding the client on when they need to make aliquots and all sorts of things like that so that the work is handled most efficiently. So here's an example where they entered the collection date, but they didn't enter a collection time. And what we've done is pop up an error screen that says empty collection date or time, a valid collection date and time are required. So they can't get past this until they go up there and put in the collection time. Here's a case where they haven't submitted the correct number of tubes. And so we have a detailed message up here and a pop-up window. And the window says reducing tube count may increase the turnaround time and may compromise the specimen. Required specimen volume remains the same, and we're trying to encourage them to have split the specimen into two tubes to get the optimal performance of the tests and the optimal turnaround time. So in the area of specimen and shipment tracking, there are a number of software systems that have been developed. Some of these work for the hospital laboratory that may be doing an outreach program and have couriers picking up at physicians' offices, and they can actually, if they have a barcoded system type of thing in place, they can actually track the specimens that they're picking up from the doctor's offices. But it also is a system that's applicable for reference labs, and quite a number of reference labs have now implemented such systems. There are some commercially available systems that the AirClick system and the Gajima system, which was separate but was purchased by Cerner, are two that are commercially available and that I know of that are being used by reference laboratories or are being used. I know the Gajima system is actually being used in that case that I described earlier, a hospital lab with a large outreach network, and their couriers are picking up at physicians' offices. Extend Data has some solutions, and BoxLogic is not doesn't have an off-the-shelf solution, but is willing to write some custom solutions for someone that's interested in working with them. This is a system that we're developing internally at ARUP. It uses a more ruggedized symbol device that has a barcode reader up here at the top, and we're using this to scan bags in the hospital reference send-out departments in their laboratories as we pick these bags up, scan these bags, and track these bags by their barcode numbers. Then as we pack those bags into shipping containers, they're all being recorded. So you can see different icons on this screen. Maybe you can see, I guess if you're up close, but it says scan bags. It says in the middle one says pack boxes. Then it says on the right, send shipment. This one is pickup shipments would be our couriers going to the airport. They can stand there right there as these boxes are coming off the carousel at the airport and scan the barcodes on the boxes so that we could go immediately to Delta and say, okay, we were expecting at this time when I'm here at the airport, we were expecting this other group of three or four boxes and they didn't arrive. Can you start tracing these? In the old system, we would have to wait till the courier was back at the laboratory and we'd checked all of the box numbers and then we'd pick up the phone and call Delta and say, we're missing some boxes, can you start tracing them? Modify shipment, export data, configure and log out. So a number of menu choices. And then here is just a simple screen that when they're scanning the bags, so here was the last bag number scanned and here's two previous bag number scans. And they're, all of these bags that are being scanned in are refrigerated bags. And when they would when they would finish scanning in the refrigerated bags, they could change the temperature and scan in the frozen bags or whatever. So this is a system we're developing in our IT department for internal use. But as I at the outset, I indicated some commercial systems that are available too. And then here's the main screen that an operator would see back in on a main PC in the home office, tracking particular boxes. So it shows the carrier Delta Airlines, the city of origin Denver, Denver International Airport, a fictitious courier service, and a fictitious caller from the courier service. In the case of the automated system with the handheld device, this would be the courier that's assigned to that particular device number. So it's a wireless system that's downloading, and that wireless system is replacing an earlier, more manual system in which that courier would actually have to call in the contents, the different box numbers that they were shipping to us. And then you see down the left side the box numbers and the description of the type of box and the contents and information about when the information was placed into the record. So now continuing on with pre-analytical activities. Again, in our accessioning process then, as we receive these specimens coming in from our clients, we have tried to design into this software, which we call ESP, or Expert Specimen Processing, we've tried to design in this a lot of rules that will guide the processor to do things correctly. So as an example, most LIS systems have a single specimen type in the database for each test. And if you order the test in that LIS, it's expecting to be a frozen serum or whatever it's supposed to be. And that's what's stated in the LIS. However, in the laboratory, you will probably in many cases be willing to do the test on some other specimen, not the one that's just in the LIS. And so in the traditional specimen processing department, it's always been a memorization activity for the processors. And remember, in all of our laboratories, processors typically have a high school education and can type a certain number of words per minute, and that's the requirements to be a processor. And that doesn't mean they've had any kind of laboratory or medical background when they take that job. But processors, over time, memorize that, oh, it's not just a frozen serum for this test that's okay, a frozen plasma is okay. Or they'll take a refrigerated specimen as well. And so that became a memorization kind of thing. But if think for a moment of a laboratory test menu of 2,500 different tests and trying to memorize all the different acceptable specimen types for all of these different tests, it's a humongous problem. No one memorizes that. And so more often what would happen in the real specimen processing department is that someone says, well, this specimen is not what the screen says it should be, and so they ask the employee sitting next to them, is this okay for this test? And often that employee would say, I don't know, why don't you ask the supervisor? And you look around and you can't find the supervisor because they're in a meeting. And then they say, well, try calling the lab. And you call the lab and they're on break. So you can waste an incredible amount of time trying to get an answer to a question like that. And so what we built into this rules-based accessioning system was all of the acceptable specimen types for all of the tests that are built in the database. This software guides aliquoting. It guides the container type because we require a specific container to fit on specific analyzers. And so there's some tests that any old tube will do, but there's some tests that a specific tube is required, which is what we call our standard tube. And so all of that logic is contained in this rules-based system that I'm talking about here. And what that meant was that the training time for training new specimen processors just to get to a minimally acceptable level of competency was reduced from about 6 months on average to 6 weeks on average, and for the good people, 4 weeks. And that means that they can, with a minimum of 4 weeks of training with this rules-based system that's really guiding them through the accessioning process, they can be productive and be put on the line. So here's just an example in this particular screen of a pop-up window that popped up just to simply warn the individual that's processing the specimen that the temperature on this particular specimen is critical. Here's a pop-up window that pops up to warn them that they don't have enough specimen for the tests that are ordered. In this case, both a B12 and a Raji cell were ordered on this particular patient, and they don't have enough to do those two tests, and so they have to make a decision, and the decision may be to create an exception, have the exception handling department call the client and say, okay, which of the two tests is most important to you, because you're going to have to submit another specimen to do the other test. Here you can see the pop-up window that comes up what I was talking about earlier about having all of the acceptable specimen types. So you can see that either an ambient or a refrigerated blood or an ambient or a refrigerated dark blue top tube, all three temperature types on one urine, for one of the tests, but there's another urine that up here at the top, which has to be frozen for a particular test. And this is just a little table that allows the employee to use the mouse, or they can scroll or whatever, just as to indicate what specimens they have that have been submitted for this particular panel. There's a lot of automation that exists in the laboratory, and I'm not going to talk about all of the different systems that are available from all the different vendors. That's pretty much standard. All those systems are being successfully interfaced to all the major LIS vendors, so on and so forth. But what I thought I might do is go through some activities that go on in the way of automation that do involve the LIS, with the main one being automated aliquoting, where the LIS can guide the system in making aliquots as necessary for the tests that are ordered. And some of the successful aliquoter systems that are available include one from a German company called PVT that's shown here, and I'll be talking about this later on because they also have a camera quality system. But the aliquoter exists in this part of this system, and the output tubes are over on this side. This is a monstrous system that's been installed last year at the Kaiser Permanente Core Laboratory in Richmond, California. It's built by a company called Motoman, which is an industrial robotics company. But it has six Alloca aliquoters that are shown here off to the left. That's Alloca is a Japanese company. Here's a close-up. And so they are taking input tubes, communicating with the LIS, and then making the aliquots for various analyzers or for referral tests or whatever that are in their system. And this huge system that that's shown here for this core laboratory was designed to handle more than 30,000 specimens a day. It's a very high-volume system. I want to talk a little bit or use as an example automation at our laboratory in Salt Lake City. And so this is a video clip that I'm going to play and I'm going to narrate as we go on. And there's a graphic here that shows all of the specimens coming in to Salt Lake City from all over the country. And I actually put this graphic in because a number of years ago I was lecturing in Japan, and Dr. Sasaki, who was the grandfather of laboratory automation, didn't understand that ARUP was a reference laboratory. And he said, well, I can't understand why a hospital laboratory at the University of Utah needs all this automation that he knew we had. And I had to explain to him we were a reference laboratory. At any rate, you see, that was an ESP processor. Now they've put specimens in a carrier that are going on our track system. This is just a view along the side of the specimen processing department that has about 100 workstations. The number keeps growing constantly, and I don't know what the latest count is, but around 100. And you see specimens moving on this automation system. This is a very large switching system in here, which really resembles a railroad switchyard. So are there a lot of IT systems involved in doing this? Absolutely. You can see a lot of specimens flowing here to different high-speed sorters, which we'll get to see in a moment. These are specimens coming back towards sorters for storage, which we'll also get to see in a moment. This is not a particularly high-volume point in time. That's what it looks like most of the time. Here are some of the high-speed sorters that sort the specimens for the laboratory sections for testing. We have actually 8 of these sorters. Each of them can sort 1,000 specimens per hour into 30 different sort groups. So this is a total automation system that's much larger than what would be in a hospital laboratory because it has the capability of handling up to 8,000 specimens per hour. Something that we need, and in fact, we're already designing the next one to even greater. And then once tests are finished, have been completed, and the specimens brought back to either head to storage or to be rerouted for additional testing, they're placed on this loading machine that you see here, and it strips off a row of tubes and feeds them back onto that track system. Majority of the specimens are being routed to storage. Only about 4% are what we call reroutes. That is to say, they have a second test ordered on the specimen, and they're going to reroute past the storage sorters and go back through that main big switching system where they can be delivered again to a primary sorter. This is one of the two storage auto sorters. Now the other one's coming into view over here on the left. Each of these storage auto sorters can store about 1,100 specimens per hour. We're now running these at about 75% of capacity, so we're already designing the next storage sorter of the future. It's going to be a $1 million machine that can store 4,000 per hour, and it's going to be pretty impressive a year from now when we have that in. And we're going to take it off the track because, in fact, it's far more powerful, so powerful the track can't keep up with it. So it'll have an automated loading system, something like that loading device that you saw on the previous part of this video. So this sorter has a barcode reader, and it picks up 6 tubes at a time. There you see the barcode reader, and then sorts into different trays or racks that are along this end over here. And then when these trays are full, we take them out and put them into either the storage freezer or a walk-in refrigerator. So you, the screen shifted before I could explain what we were looking at. But there are trays along here for 14-day frozen, 30-day frozen, 14-day refrigerated, and then there are smaller racks because the volumes are smaller for categories like 60-day frozen, 90-day frozen, 9-month frozen, and so on. But the operator can take out a tray when it's full and then put a new tray in, and as you just saw a minute ago, read the barcode on the end of the tray and read the barcode in the drawer, and that communicates with the system as to what tray is in that particular drawer. And then the empty carriers for the track are snapped together into what we call a glop. These carriers are like Lego blocks, actually, and they snap together in two dimensions and make blocks. Meanwhile, the operator takes the tray over to an input conveyor to go into the storage system, the storage freezer, and this front room is a refrigerated room, and this door leads into the freezer. This is a video shot inside the freezer. There are large robotic, what we call shuttle cranes, down these aisles. Here you can see one of the shuttle cranes coming out. Here you see a tray going to a loading station. And this shuttle crane is picking up a tray that it's going to put in storage. And there's another shuttle crane that just took off to go pick up some specimens. Here comes a tray in that had actually had a cover over it because of the contents were bags that we didn't want to have caught in any of the robotics. So now this is a longitudinal view down one of those aisles, and you can see the shuttle crane putting two trays away and then picking up two trays, and it'll come back out. And so here it's going to head back out to this loading station. And it's going to, there are trays there, and it's going to unload those trays over here on the side. And then we'll see a view of the tray moving forward on a conveyor and over here to come back out to that refrigerated room because someone has requested a specimen for a repeat test or an additional test. So here's the pneumatic door that leads from the freezer back into the refrigerated anteroom. This is a little blocking device. If it's going to go through this automated system over here that we'll see in a moment for the tube to be automatically picked out of that tray, it proceeds that way. But if it can come forward to a manual exit door for what we call a manual pick. So we're also storing things like urine cups and other kinds of containers. But now here you see a tray that came into one of these Motoman storage This is the what we call the ASRS sorter, and it picked that tube out of the tray and then released the tray, and that tray's headed right back into the freezer. It hasn't even been out of the freezer but a minute. And so as employees enter checkout requests into the computer system, they can't walk to this system fast enough. Those specimens are waiting for them in about 2.5 minutes on average. And so here you see an employee that retrieved a specimen and read the barcode on the rack to check out all the specimens in the rack to her and walked away. But this is a manual tray that's then coming out. Sometimes these manual trays consist of really odd-sized tubes that don't work in the robotic systems, and they have to pick the specimens by hand. So this employee will have a sheet of paper that she's printed from the computer that has the tray number, row number, column number, of the specimens she's checking out. She finds that specimen and then goes over and checks it out to herself each tube at a time. So that video sort of shows our automation from one end to the other, or most of it. I would like, though, to spend a little bit of time talking about that concept that I mentioned earlier, where machine vision systems that have been taken from industry are now being used for automation of quality inspection in clinical laboratories. And there are a number of our standard clinical laboratory vendors that have now put some of these systems into place. So this is the Beckman Coulter Automate system that was, I think, announced about 2.5 years ago at an AACC meeting. And over here on the right-hand side is an LED machine vision system that can look through the side of the tube through as many as three thicknesses of labels. It can see the top of the packed cells, the top of the serum after the tube's been centrifuged, and then it can calculate, based on the diameter of the tube, the volume of that serum that's above the cells, above the packed cells. So it knows how much it has for the tests that have been ordered and how much it may aliquot into two or three different tubes for different tests. This is one of the SCARA robot systems that's in that big Motoman system at Kaiser Permanente. And in the corner of this system is a machine vision system, a camera system, that can look at the tube, determine the size of the tube and its cap color, and then compare that to information in the LIS as to whether that is the correct tube for the test. This is a system from Olympus America. Beckman just bought Olympus, I think I saw in the news here in the last week or two. But this has a very similar system. This system can look through the side of a tube, through labels, and can detect the top of the packed cells, the top of the serum, and from the diameter of the tube, determine the volume. And actually, you see a little graphic representation here, and here's the serum right in here, and you can see this spectrophotometric peak changing in to show exactly where the serum is, and then they, from the diameter of the tube, they can calculate the volume. And then I showed this photograph before of the PVT quality, the PVT workstation for aliquoting, which has one of these, what they call the QS1 camera quality system. This quality system camera does determine, similar to that Motoman thing, the size and the presence of the stopper for decapping and recapping purposes, but also combining that information with tube size to compare to the LIS information or the barcode information, and can send an incorrect tube to a reject rack. It also can do liquid level detection and volume calculation, and something that they can do, which none of the other systems can do yet, but everybody's working to get there, I can assure you that, is checking for the presence of hemolysis, lipemia, and icterus, and trying to do a semi type of quantitation, three categories for each. To do this, though, they require 6.5 millimeters of unlabeled tube window. And for reference laboratories, there's no unlabeled part on the side of a tube, because you have a tube that starts out with maybe the manufacturer's label on it, the doctor's office puts a label on it, the hospital laboratory puts a label on it, the reference laboratory puts a label on it, and the tube is covered with that. And that's why we saw in the Beckman Coulter, the Olympus systems, they can look through labels. And the systems we're working on can look through labels as well. No one has really gotten the problem of looking through the labels to pick up interfering substances solved yet, but there's a lot of us working on that. So this is still from that PVT system, and just simply shows that they're inspecting this specimen, and then they've got some gradations over here about the quality of the specimen being good, and zeros for the hemolysis, icterus, and lipemia, and so on. Now, some research projects that we're doing at ARUP in this area of quality inspections. There are really several of them. Two examples that I'll show here is detection of minimum and maximum volumes in a specimen tube and detection of mislabeled specimens. This was a project that for a graduate student in our College of Engineering, and basically he developed a system which has two light sources and two detectors, and so Here is one of our standard tubes, sort of a CAD drawing of one of our standard tubes, and this light source is sending a beam across towards the bottom of this is a false bottom tube, and so the actual bottom of the specimen is a conical piece right here, this part. But the light beam is going across here, and there's actually a mirror in here, and so there's actually light beams at two wavelengths, one wavelength from this region and one wavelength from this region, and I'll come back and explain that in a moment. And then there's a detector on the other side, and then there's a similar thing up here at what would be the level we've chosen to be a maximum level that we would want in the tube, because if the cap was off and the tube is moving around in a robotic system, it could spill, or it might be too full for a particular analyzer. And again, a mirror system so that beams at two wavelengths can be sent through. And what the student and his professor figured out was that at this lower wavelength in the 800s, there virtually was no difference in the absorbance between liquid and air. And the liquid could be water, it could be serum, it could be urine, could be anything. But there was very little difference. But out here in this region of the infrared, around 1500 to 1600, there was several log cycles difference between the absorbance when liquid was present versus when air was present. And so what we do then is a ratio of the reading here and the reading over here in the 800s, and this eliminates the impact of the label. Because if all the light is reduced because you have a label around the tube, if you have liquid present, you still see this big ratio. You just have less light. If you have three labels around the tube, or in fact, this system works with up to six labels. And where does the six come from? Well, if you put three labels on a tube, there's a front side and a back side, because the light's got to go all the way through the tube. So it's got to go through actually six thicknesses of labels. And so this is working very successfully, and we've built a robotic version of that, which you can see here. And there's a gripper device right in here. It lifts the tube up out of the carrier off the track, holds it in front of the light beams for just a fraction of a second, and then puts it back in the tube. And I had gathered a group of about 15 people, and we watched, and we didn't tell the student what the tubes were. We gave them these tubes sort of blind, and there was three little LED lights on the other side of this machine. One said pass, one said fail, and so he'd put the tube in, and the lights would blink. Excuse me, I hit the button by accident on the laser, and the lights would blink, and he hit every one of them. So it was a very impressive demonstration. The other system that we've been trying to work on, been working on this for more than 3 years, and that's to try to solve the issue of mislabeled specimens. And I'm not talking about solving human error, what causes the specimen to be mislabeled initially, but rather trying to deal with it at a downstream level. Mislabeled lab specimens are a very significant element of U.S. patient errors. I think all of us know that. Dr. Myers really brought that home to us in his talk. There's been a CAP Q-probe study published just this past October. Elizabeth Weger was the lead author on this article in the Archives of Pathology and Lab Medicine, showing an incident rate of almost one in 10,000. In the CAP today of this past January, a second Q-probe study was described just for blood banks, which had an error rate of 12-fold higher, over 1%, 1.12%. And this is being submitted right now to the Archives of Pathology and Lab Medicine. Richard Freeberg and Chris Lemon from the University of Utah are two of the participants in that study. At ARUP, our processing department only mislabels one in 10,000. We're 10 times better than the Q-probe. We should celebrate. Wrong. We should not celebrate. That's unbelievably, unacceptably high to me. And I think to all of us. Now, we have various downstream inspections in place. Every employee handling a specimen is required to look at that specimen and peel back the labels and make sure it's correctly labeled. So they identify and correct 95 to 96% of those mislabeled specimens. But still, when you do the math, we have about 1 in 200,000 that gets out. Well, that's in a laboratory doing receiving almost 40,000 specimens a day. That's one a week or more, and that's still way too many. In terms of, and those are the only ones we know about. These are ones where the client calls back and says, the result that you reported doesn't match what we were expecting. Can you repeat it? We go and pull the specimen out of that of the freezer system to repeat it, and lo and behold, we discover it was mislabeled. So there may be some that we don't ever find out about because the results were normal or the results matched what client expected, or at least they didn't know to question it. So we need better systems, and one of the things that's happening is a CLSI project to develop a consensus national standard for the format and content of a specimen label, and primarily to get the patient name in the same place on every label in every laboratory in the country. I looked at a lot of labels for the last several years, and patient name can be on the left side of the label, the right side of the label, the middle of the label, the first line, second line, third line, fourth line, fifth line. They're all over the place. And how else could we expect not to have mistakes when we're having employees looking at these specimens, but the patient name moves? It's not always in the same place. And the patient name is probably the number one identifier for specimen labels. So we're working on this standard. Dr. Belise is on the committee with me. 40 other people are on the committee. It's really exciting. We expect to be voting at the committee level on this draft standard later this spring, probably by June, and a final approved standard on the CLSI schedule would be sometime the summer of 2010. But at ARUP, we're working on a machine vision, optical character verification project to see if we can't reduce that 4 to 5% of mislabeled specimens that still get out the door of our laboratory. And basically, this is a system that was developed for industry. It's being used to inspect cans of Coke or bottles of aspirin or whatever, and specimens, round containers, let's not call them specimens, round containers are passing by four cameras on a moving conveyor system. That's as simple as that. And the four cameras take an image simultaneously, and then there's a computer software system that melds those four images together into a single two-dimensional image, which is basically the unwrapped surface of this round object. So this is a CAD drawing of the system we built. Here are the four cameras in the four corners here. This is our automated track system where specimens could move by at a speed of up to 2,000 per hour. These were to be light sources, but on the equidistant around, but we've changed it now to a ring light system. And this is the actual system. So here you see a tube being held up by a robotic lifting device up out of the carrier. Here's the ring light at the top. These are just reflective panels. You can see two of the cameras here on the side going through holes of these reflective panels. You can't see the other two cameras on the other two sides in this particular image. And I'm going to show you two tubes. I've blacked out the name, the last names, so we don't break any HIPAA laws here in this meeting. But here was this tube would be a match because the first name Jason on our label matches Jason on this other label. We've done a couple of things in the design of this system is we've put a little black square that you can see right here in front of the patient name. The combination of that black square and the barcode over here tells the computer system that this is our label. It knows the dimensions of our label. So now it knows the perimeter of our label. And so now the software logic looks outside the zone of that label from there to there. It looks at every other part of the image and trying to find a matching character string that matches what we think it's supposed to be. So we're not reading the name on this label. We use the barcode, look in our system, and find out that this is Jason. And then it's looking for Jason and the matching last name on the other label. Here you see over to the left the four different images from the four different cameras that have been sewn together. And if you look at this very closely and try to divide this into fourths, it's very difficult to pick out the seams. I mean, this is really pretty exquisite technology. Here's a failure. Here you see the four images over here. Here you see our label here. There's the black dot. This is our tracking barcode for our automation. The label that we got printed, because that's what it was in our computer system, said Mike for the first name, but on the customer label it said Michael A. I can assure you that we see mismatches that are far worse than this. Sometimes I wonder if the employee was really talking about last night's date or the jazz game or the smoking dope or what. I mean, sometimes when I make jokes about this at meetings, I get told by executives to go see human resources. I can't do that. So, but anyway, this can be a serious problem for all of us, these mislabeled specimens. So I'm really optimistic that this camera system, we'll have it in. The software developer is very close to finishing this and should have it in, so we can install it, probably, I'm hoping, in 4 or 5 weeks. I want to go through quickly things that probably many of you are familiar with, how IT gets used through various steps in the analytical process, middleware, auto-verification, quality control, special calculated results, reflexive testing. I think we all are familiar with what middleware is. It's software that people have developed to fill a gap, frankly, in what the LIS was capable of providing to us and what we got out of our analyzers. And middleware has continued to evolve, and it's now providing much more than it used to provide previously. Laboratories generally determine their own rules for what they want to do with middleware, so every laboratory is different. And so in some cases, rules may just simply lead to comments that are posted with the result, or it could lead to actions by the laboratory, such as to repeat a test with dilution or to perform an ultracentrifugation to remove lipemia or something like that. So here are a few examples from our laboratory, from our high-volume core chemistry laboratory for aldolase, and these are just two of them. If the hemolysis index or the icterus index exceeds a certain number, you simply put a comment on the report. If the lipemic index is above a certain number, then that specimen is going to be ultracentrifuged. In an iron binding capacity, if we have an exorbitantly high number, we're going to order a calcium just to see if that specimen might have been an EDTA plasma instead of a serum. High-sensitivity CRP, the middleware guides us with three tertiles of results, which each result leads to a different comment that gets posted. And in another case, if the analyzer tells the middleware the results outside the analytic range for the test, the middleware rules for that test will post a comment back to the laboratory to repeat upon dilution. So these are just a few examples of ways that we use middleware, and I'm sure there's lots of other ways that people are using middleware. Auto-verification in some laboratories is being done within systems that can be part of the LIS or in some other cases as part of the middleware. Each laboratory needs to set their own rules for every test that they're going to auto-verify. Even though shown at the bottom, the CLSI developed a guideline. I see Steve Kahn in the back, and he may remember a dinner that several of us were at several of us of the AACC folks were at, and I asked a question to the group at dinner, did anybody think we should have a standard for auto verification? And the first reaction from the folks, oh, no, we're all doing it. We don't need any guidelines. And then all of a sudden everybody said, wait a minute, yeah, there's no one out there telling other people how to do this. I mean, even though we in our laboratories, like Steve's laboratory and my laboratory, were doing auto verification. So I went back to CLSI and proposed that we develop this standard. I recruited Bill Neely to head it up. One of the big concerns was California. So I called up Karen Nickel, who I had known for years, and she was enthusiastic, and she says, I want to be on the committee. So guess what? California is adopting the CLSI guidelines for and permitting auto verification, which they never used to do. So that was a nice success story. And that CLSI guideline has been one of the biggest sellers in the CLSI system. Quality control, we're all familiar with quality control. I've just listed a variety of systems here. I've indicated one vendor system, but there are actually several vendor systems. One can do simple rules. One can do more complex rules, so-called Westgard rules, Levy-Jennings plots. You can do daily test means. If you're doing a lot of physician office business, you can do daily test means, which would be more effective for normal populations. Another thing that you can do, which we do at our laboratory, is following the test median results over time versus certain control ranges, which can identify shifts in reagent lots. Special calculated results. Urine tests, doing whatever the urine test is per gram of creatinine, is a standard one I think that most laboratories are familiar with. RBC folates. Free testosterone and bioavailable testosterone. We actually have a complex spreadsheet that our endocrinologists placed in PathNet Discern along with some complex formulas so that it uses the measured results for the sex hormone binding globulin and total testosterone along with the binding constants for albumin and SHBG to then calculate the results for the free testosterone and the bioavailable testosterone. And then we're probably all familiar with graphs of serum parathyroid hormone versus serum calcium. I wanted to show this because in my old life, I ran a parathyroid hormone assay with the laboratory business owned by Upjohn in Kalamazoo going back. I had the very first one of these graphs. I won't take credit for inventing the idea because a colleague of mine at the Mayo Clinic actually thought of it first, but I had the first one that was attached to a patient test report in 1972. And this is a version from when the lab business was sold from Upjohn to Smith Kline that we used at Smith Kline. But so this group of circles down here are normal individuals, patients with primary hyperparathyroidism, patients with secondary hyperparathyroidism. We would feed these forms through the computer, put the patient's name and an ID number at the top, and then it would drop down in here somewhere and put an X for the patient's result. Now, this was great when you were mailing reports, but today no one can mail reports, and so the graphs that are coming across from computer systems over the interfaces between reference labs and hospital labs or whatever won't ever look as nice as this. Unless something really slick can be invented by the IT folks. Anyway, and then reflexive testing. I have a few examples here. We're all familiar with how computer systems can help guide us with reflexive testing. Now, under the law, you have to order the test profile that includes the reflexive test if the result is expected to be high. So you can order a PSA with a reflex to the free PSA. And if you don't order it, then you have to call up and order it later. But the law does not allow reflex tests to be added directly to just a PSA result by itself, and so on. And I, in preparing this slide, looked in the ARUP user's guide, and we had some 224 reflexive test offerings that were like this, and I just selected a few as examples of this. So it's becoming widespread. And then finally, this is just a photograph of one of those specimen storage sorters that I had in the video. You saw this a little bit up closer looking from the inside, but this is a two-dimensional or three-dimensional CAD drawing of that big two-story freezer that's 60 feet long and 26 feet high, 30 feet wide, that can hold almost 2.35 million specimens, and it's only about a third full. I will be long gone from ARUP before this one's ever full. It's been, and what it's done for productivity is pretty amazing. At any rate, not everybody wants the world's largest freezer or has room for that. So for most laboratories, if you can get a storage capability in your LIS, that's great. But some laboratories don't even have that. And so what I put on this slide were some very inexpensive operations. That are PC systems that you can buy this software, load it in any PC in your laboratory, put a barcode reader on it, and then you can store specimens by tray number or rack number, however you want to do it, row number, column number. And all of these, I have actually seen all of these in operation myself as I have visited laboratories, and they work very well. So in retrieving specimens for additional testing and so on, that kind of a storage system works great. And then also those kinds of systems can aid in the process of retrieving the expired trays for discard. Now this is just the operator screen in our storage area on the outside of that freezer system. And this just shows a number of employees down the left who've requested specimens to be checked out, and then some of them have already come to pick those up. You can see some of those requests are still building, but some are complete. Once they come and pick them up to check out, they'll clear off of this screen. And then when we're going to go build a discard list, I'm not at discard yet. I'm just showing some specimen tracking in our computer system throughout that entire track system. And this is that ESP system, and it just shows arriving at a sorter lane. The next stop is shown over here at the on the right, and then it's back on the track, and now it goes again to another central sorter lane for another test. The next stop then is going to be storage, so now it's tracked into storage. Somebody checked it out to repeat a test. It exited storage, and then it went back to storage. So we've put this kind of tracking into the system, and as we develop more of these systems, the tracking will become even more sophisticated. So we get to specimen discard, and one can pull a list of what they want to discard. And I want to just show this little machine. This is like a 10-second video that our bioengineers built. One of the problems we had was that the little centering rings that hold the specimens in the trays, you see them, they were in that tray there, you couldn't turn the tray over and dump the tray. The only way you could do this was stand the tray up on end and pull all the tubes out by hand, and think of 50 trays a day, 450 tubes per tray. So it was not very effective. And then when those specimens are finished, we have this automated system, a combination sterilizer shredder that was built by a company called Red Bag Solutions. Their website was shown there. And this is just basically a very large centrifuge. And I took some video of the operator just throwing in a half a dozen bags. Actually, he'll put in 20 or 25 bags when he's doing this until the thing is full. It's based on weight, and he's pulling them off of a cart that's sitting on a scale. And then he closes up the centrifuge and turns it on. And it takes about 20 to 25 minutes. And tubes are constant. There's a big grinder in the bottom, a big blade that's grinding up all these tubes. And the stuff that's inside there is constantly recycled. So these things pass by those grinder blades constantly. So after 20 or 25 minutes, they're not only sterilized to remove any viruses or whatever might be present, but it's shredded. You can see the output that's coming out down here. You can see a little bit of steam arising about it. There's a machine in the back up here that removes the water, but you see a little bit of steam, and then I'm going to show a view down into this container. And you can see this pile of shredded waste. So this all goes to a landfill. It's compacted, it's de-identified, and it's not going to give anybody AIDS or hepatitis or whatever. So I've shown you all these steps in the process from start to finish. And in many cases, I think it's very logical about how information technology can impact the quality of the testing, but I've left it for you on a logical level. I've never offered a shred of proof, and so I threw one slide in, and this is lost specimens. And when I arrived at ARUP 17 years ago, the lost specimen rate was almost, some months, was 1 in 1,000. It was, to me, horribly high. And so there were some months that were up here, even higher than this high point. This was an average for a year. But you can see how all of these different automation processes like ESP and some of these others that guide the aliquoting, and this slide is really the sum of so many of those processes that I've talked about today. And this is a log scale, and this is just a very steady decline, and it's almost at Six Sigma levels. Now, our quality manager plots this as, because there can be multiple tests on the same tube, meaning multiple opportunities to lose the tube. So she plots this per build units, and we have had several months. These low months in here are actually below Six Sigma levels, plotted on a build unit basis. I like the idea that I can go back to the early 90s. Our billing system changed in here, and the definition of a build unit changed. And so I track it on the specimen basis. But clearly, I think there's no question that IT systems can positively impact the quality of clinical laboratory testing, all the way from the creation of the test order to the disposal of specimens. There are numerous opportunities for automating manual processes beyond the automation that's based on robotics. And I think through the elimination of manual steps and the review of routine results, we can significantly improve the quality of the clinical laboratory testing, reduce patient errors. And I would always say that automation by itself is usually not successful without good supporting information technology systems. Thank you very much.
You would come up to the front of the room. As soon as Jeff gets up, we'll ask some questions. I want to point out one thing to you that I'm going to repeat later on, but at this conference, at this workshop, and in the plenary conference, we're going to be doing conference or back-channel tweeting. Essentially, on Twitter, I have set up an account on Twitter called Lab Infotech, and this is a vehicle for you to comment or enter questions without leaving your seat, using the browser in your cell phone. So, in fact, if you want to submit a question or comment, and I've been doing this throughout the workshop, what you need to do is log on to Twitter, and it's a free registration, and essentially you need to create your own account. But then inside Twitter, if you put an @ Lab Infotech, and then input your comment or question up to 140 characters, I will be monitoring that. Now, if you want to see the pure flow of comments or questions, just point your browser to www.twitter.com/labinfotech, and you can see the stream of comments. The purpose of this is to allow you to comment or submit questions without leaving your chair. It's a way of electronifying your submission of comments or questions. I'll explain this again later, but I just wanted to give you an early view at this. So we have our two experts sitting. This has been an outstanding conference. We have our two experts sitting at the on the stage, and I have a portable microphone, and you can use this or stand up and ask your questions and direct them to either one of our faculty members. We will essentially recess in about 8 minutes. Box lunches will be brought into this room, and then the plenary conference reconvenes at 1:30. So do you have any questions? I can pass you the mic or just stand up.
Well, we already, okay.
Well, that's the problem.
Right? Why don't you use ARUP?
Well, you know, that's a very good question. And a friend of mine, Clem McDonald, led this effort to develop a system called LOINC a long time ago. And LOINC's been out there, and it's widely available. We have I can't tell you what LOINC stands for. Ray can. Sorry. but the reality is that nobody's using LOINC very much at all. And the problem is that because now there's 100 versions of glucose in LOINC because everybody wants their own special version. And so it becomes very difficult, as you just described, to translate from a listing at one laboratory to a listing at another laboratory and see if those are even equivalent. And you can only check if they're equivalent based on the test name. You can't check, basically, at the level you're checking, if they're equivalent in methodology. And that's one of the big problems that all of us have with, you know, reimbursement systems, is because sometimes we're reimbursed for very inexpensive methodologies which don't have any resemblance to the expensive technologies we offer today for some of these tests and so on. It's a real problem. No.
Any other questions? I have a question for Jeff. Jeff, you alluded to the sort of cultural issues pertaining to pathologists, and to a certain extent, some of them reinforce your quest for quality, and some of them retard your. And I was wondering if you could sort of discuss in general terms the sort of culture of the pathologists and ways in which they obviously make safety easier, but also those that you have to get over in order to pursue the goals that you're pursuing.
Yeah, that's a great question, and we could talk about a lot of different things, but I think in truth most of what's been designed in surgical pathology has been designed for the physicians, and by that I mean for the pathologists. CAP suggests, actually I was told during our most recent inspection, requires that quality assurance turn-on time data be expressed in a five-day work week. I don't know any patients who live five-day work weeks. They all live 7 days. I mean, you know, the lucky ones. And that to me says volumes about how we tend to view quality. We'd prefer to view quality in a way that makes our current choices comfortable. I think in various practice environments, that's a huge barrier to get past. Who are we designing for? We're designing for patients. I think the other issue that's common in surgical pathology is the sense that Standardization is the enemy of quality rather than the other way around. If you go into any histology laboratory, at least most histology laboratories, you'll see that certain processes are done four different ways. And when you ask why, the answer is, well, this doctor prefers it this way, and this doctor prefers it this way, and another doctor prefers it this way, with really no good rationale or evidence basis for those choices. So I think the sense of individualism and entitlement really gets in the way of standardization when you talk about that in the context of surgical pathology. So I think there are a number of cultural issues, but for me, those are the two primary targets. We've designed for the doctors, and view standardization as the problem rather than the solution. And I've actually seen evidence of that. One of the very first data I saw after getting to Michigan was in April of 06. And you'll remember this, Yule, because that was when we were on our way to a site visit, and I was so excited I showed you this statistical control chart. It was my first data at Michigan. It was drawn from PathNet with a lot of effort, and it was a statistical control chart that showed turnaround time over a decade plus. And what it showed was that in July of 2000, we went off the rails and continued to lose ground ever since. And it was very clear that something happened in July of 2000. And I knew someone knew the answer. When I presented that data at a faculty meeting, people scratched their heads and said, I don't know what happened. Don't know what happened in July of 2000, but it was very clear something happened. So I sent out an email to everybody and said, someone please tell me what happened. And a fellow responded and said, I know exactly what happened. He said, what happened in July of 2000, that was our first step toward subspecialization. And we started with two subspecialty services, GYN and GU. And he said, when those were first launched in July of 2000, something the faculty had all forgotten, he said, we signed out when the faculty felt like signing out, which turned out to be some weeks, 2 or 3 days of the week. And the other days, the faculty would say, well, I'm a little busy today. And actually, what was interesting was we never recovered from that. It actually became a standard of performance. Now, I have to qualify that. That may sound like I've got bad faculty. I've got great faculty. I mean, I'd put my faculty up against anybody, but it was a cultural issue that we were designing subspecialty services for the convenience of our faculty and not to care for patients. So I think, for me, those are the challenges.
I would like to follow up on that. You alluded to the time to diagnosis. And also you talked about continuous flow processing. And like it or not, I think we're continuously being judged on more and more rapid turnaround time. And coupled with continuous flow processing, do you see a time when this will drive us into much longer hours per day and weekend work in order to pursue a report, let's say, before the sun sets for many or most specimens?
Yeah, well, that's a great question, and I think that's everybody's fear. But I think we have lots of progress that can be made without expanding our work days or working into the weekends. Although personally, I think it's odd that we live in a country where I can buy condoms at Walmart at 3 a.m., but I can't get health care at 10 a.m. on Saturday unless I go to the ER. That's just weird. Right? I can buy a quart of milk anytime, any day, 24/7, but I can't get health care on Saturday. So I'm personally not immune to thinking about working on Saturday. In fact, during the time I was at the Mayo Clinic, we implemented Saturday sign-out over a lot of objection and concern. But at least by the time I left, it was standard operating practice, and it actually changed the way they cared for patients. I was actually quite proud of that. But I do think there are ways that we can really think imaginatively about the way we work, and the first step to that is just changing how we view patient-centered care. I hear lots of pathologists say, we don't need to turn this around in a day because the doctor's not going to see the patient for 2 weeks. And I would say the problem is that the doctor's not going to see the patient for 2 weeks. That is an insufficient reason for us not doing our job in a way that patients care about. Every patient I've ever asked, every one of them, and I ask, if you say to a patient, when would you like to know the results of your biopsy? They always say the same thing, as soon as possible. Could I know today? And we say, well, now you can't know that. The truth is you could know that. And when doctors have family members who are getting biopsies, that's what they ask for, because they call me. They say, look, I know this isn't your standard process, but is there any way I could know today? And we say, well, there is a way. So I think we can figure it out. I think we have to be imaginative, and I think we have to change fundamentally how we view our jobs and the fact that we're here to serve patients and not serve ourselves.
I very much applaud your comments. I'm Ray Aller, just wanted to get back to the earlier comment about a standard test code. We could, in fact, use the LOINC codes in the way you're talking about. And by the way, LOINC stands for something quite unpronounceable, Logical Observation Identifier Names and Codes. So that's why I referred to you a more memorable mnemonic. But anyway, that's...
Any other questions? Okay, the box lunches should arrive shortly. I want to thank... Go ahead. End up. Someone had a question?
Oh, no, I was...
I'm sorry. Yeah. The box lunches are here. Okay, the box lunches are on the side. I didn't even see them. I want to thank Charlie and Jeff for a wonderful workshop.